The next matter on the calendar this morning is Jonathan Bernard Edwards versus State of Minnesota. Counsel, when you approach the podium, please identify yourselves for us. Counsel for appellant may proceed.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, Jonathan Edwards. This court must reverse Mr. Edwards' conviction because he was deprived of his Sixth Amendment right to the effective assistance of counsel. His trial lawyer's decision to allow the state to admit reams of damaging hearsay evidence during its case in chief was deficient performance for at least four reasons. First, it undercut counsel's trial strategy as articulated at the post-conviction hearing, which was to try to minimize evidence of Mr. Edwards' involvement in any prostitution of the victim here, T.S. This evidence didn't minimize Mr. Edwards' involvement. It was evidence of Mr. Edwards' involvement, and its admission at trial in the state's case in chief did not help the defense case in any way. Second, counsel's stated concern about highlighting the evidence by objecting to it is completely unreasonable for several reasons. First, an objection to this evidence that was clearly hearsay would have been sustained. And had it been sustained, there would have been no evidence to highlight. Either the witness wouldn't have said the thing that is harmful, or if the witness, in fact, blurted out some piece of hearsay before the trial court could have ruled, the trial court presumably would have instructed the jury to disregard.
Let me interrupt there just for a second. When we look at the Court of Appeals opinion following the direct appeal,
yes, ma'am.
There seems to be a slightly different take on whether or not the objection would have been sustained.
Mm-hmm.
You're stating it as fact to us that if the objection had been made, it would have been sustained. And the Court of Appeals has said that it's not clear or obvious that the statements were inadmissible under the residual exception.
Mm-hmm.
So what if we're not sure that objection would have been sustained? The Court of Appeals decided it wasn't plain error for the court to admit the statements. Where does that leave us here?
Sure. I think you have to keep a couple things in mind, Your Honor. First of all, the Court of Appeals opinion in the direct appeal was referring, that language you're referring to is in the context of the question of whether this evidence was so inadmissible that the trial judge should have sua sponte stepped in to exclude it. And this court held no, the trial judge didn't have that responsibility. It wasn't that plainly inadmissible. That's a very different question than the question that's before you today. Secondly, you can look back to the context of this particular trial, because the trial judge in this case admonished at least two witnesses to not say things that other people had told them. The prosecutor admonished a witness to not say things that other people had told them. The trial judge sustained a couple of Mr. Zipko's hearsay objections where the evidence at issue did not fit into a well-recognized hearsay exception.
But not with respect to this witness, this testimony.
No, because there was no objection. But in fact, Your Honor, the first witness at page 649 and 687 of the record, this first witness at issue, there is a sustained hearsay objection towards this witness. And there is an admonishment by the trial court at page 687 to this particular witness to not say things that other people told her. The hearsay then begins one page later.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Did the admonitions that you reference that the trial court admonished witnesses not to say what other people said, were those admonitions given only in only after sustaining an objection, or were they generally given by the court sua sponte?
I believe they were given in response to sustaining an objection, Your Honor, but that goes, I think, to Judge Shellhouse's question about whether an objection would have been sustained.
Exactly. I mean, I thought if the court was doing that sua sponte in other situations, that might suggest that the court not doing it here, thought maybe it was admissible, right? Or potentially admissible, and didn't have
Yeah, no, the court did it in response to objections. The court was not, the trial court here was not going to reach out and proactively tell the witnesses not to respond to hearsay. The court was relying on the attorneys, which gets back to the question here, which is whether, you know, the question in the first appeal, the direct appeal, is whether the court plainly erred. That's a very different question than whether the attorney provided deficient performance not objecting.
But again, if this evidence was at least potentially admissible under a catch-all exception, and most district court judges are going to assume that there's some trial strategy being implemented by a lawyer. And here we have a lawyer who testified that he didn't make objections because he didn't want to highlight the testimony. So how do we get to ineffective assistance of counsel if this testimony, at least potentially, arguably, was admissible?
Mm-hmm. I think one way, Your Honor, is that Mr. Zipko didn't testify that he thought the evidence was admissible. That's not why he didn't say.
I know he didn't say that.
But that's the record you have in front of you then. The rationale for counsel's lack of action is almost controlling in an ineffective assistance case. We look at why the counsel did something. For some reasons, not objecting might be a reasonable trial tactic. If counsel didn't object for other reasons, it's not a reasonable trial tactic.
Wasn't the other reason here that there was going to be plenty of evidence that the witness wasn't that believable because of other instances of not telling the truth?
That's what Mr. Zipko thought, Your Honor, yes. But that has nothing to do with not objecting to the evidence. If you object and the evidence doesn't come in, then you don't have to worry about it. Mr. Zipko's...
But if it does come in, you've highlighted it. That's, I think, gets back to the question of, if you're not certain that it's not coming in, am I running the risk of highlighting that?
And so I think if you look at this trial record, Your Honor, that's not a reasonable risk. If Mr. Zipko had objected two or three times and had been overruled a couple of times, or if the trial judge had said to Mr. Zipko, look, in light of T.S.'s back and forth trial testimony, I'm going to take a really broad view of 807 here. I'm just going to tell you that. Then, of course, it would be reasonable to not bang your head against the wall or make the jury think that you're being obstructionist. There was no attempt here to keep out the damaging evidence. And a lot of what Mr. Zipko testified to about, I didn't want to highlight it, I hoped the jury would ignore it, that would be reasonable if it was sure that the evidence was coming in the first place. Trial counsel, of course, has to deal with, in all kinds of different ways, with damaging evidence that comes in. But what trial counsel should do is try to keep the damaging evidence out, not wave the damaging evidence in the hope that the jury will ignore it. And the foreign cases that are cited in our brief at page 15 and 16 talk about this a little bit. The federal court in Garby and the South Carolina court and the Michigan court, all looking at a trial counsel's decision, not like he didn't miss it in those cases. All of those lawyers sat there at trial and said, yep, I'm going to allow this hearsay to come in for reasons A, B, and C. And the reviewing courts looked at that and said, that is unreasonable. Your reasons for allowing this damaging evidence to come in are completely unreasonable. And they're basically the same reasons that Mr. Zipko gave. I don't want to look like I'm playing hide the ball. I wanted the jury to see her inconsistent statements. None of that should motivate a defense attorney to allow the state in its case in chief to present substantive evidence of guilt. Mr. Zipko could have cross-examined the victim on her inconsistent statements if he wanted to. Why he would do that, I have no idea, and he didn't, quite reasonably, because she said he didn't do it during the trial testimony. None of that says, okay, now the next thing I'm going to do, if you look at the chronology of witnesses here, once T.S. testified, the evidence against Mr. Edwards at the trial was the MCRC tape in which she made statements damaging to Mr. Edwards. That had come in. And T.S.'s testimony, in which she said he didn't do it, repeatedly and emphatically said he didn't do it. That's the bulk of the evidence against Mr. Edwards at the time when T.S. leaves the witness stand. I'm sorry, go ahead, Your Honor.
I hate to interrupt you, but in fairness, I want to ask you a question. First of all, I understand your argument that Mr. Zipko's performance was below an objective level of reasonableness. I understand that argument. Here's what I want to ask you. The reason this argument is being made is that the Court of Appeals, in its opinion, preserved your client's right to pursue his ineffective assistance of counsel claim. When I look at what his ineffective assistance of counsel claim was on direct appeal, it didn't include this argument. Now, I realize that the district court then, for reasons that we can't know, decided that that was the only issue preserved. But I don't know that that binds us. I mean, I know the district court conducted an evidentiary hearing, assuming that was the only issue preserved. Yep. But what if the record here reflects that that argument, the one you're making, wasn't actually preserved because it wasn't actually part of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim on the direct appeal?
I agree with that, Your Honor. I don't think that I agree with counsel for respondent that when the district post-conviction court said the Court of Appeals preserved the failure to object question, that that was incorrect. I agree with that. And this is not a claim that was raised on the direct appeal. That's Mr. Edwards' pro se claims were, but not this one. So I agree with the factual premise of your question.
But Mr.
Which
Edwards'
I think,
pro se claims didn't include this argument.
I agree with that.
Okay.
I agree with that completely. I don't have any dispute with that.
So
that again gets to the NAFLA bar issue,
yeah.
Right? So I will come back then to the language in Leak versus State from 2007 and Torres versus State from 2004, in which the Supreme Court says in Leak the claim is, quote, a claim of ineffective assistance that cannot be resolved on the trial court record alone need not be brought in a direct appeal and may be brought in a post-conviction petition, end quote. This claim, the failure to object claim, could not have been resolved on the direct appeal alone, because the direct appeal trial transcript does not reveal Mr. Zipko's reasons for not objecting to the hearsay. And until a court knows those reasons, the court cannot decide whether Mr. Zipko's performance was deficient or it wasn't deficient. Because of that, and the Supreme Court has been clear on this, when an ineffective assistance claim requires further development of a factual record, it does not need to be brought in a direct appeal. It cannot, in fact, be successfully or finally brought in a direct appeal because the reviewing court can't decide one way or the other whether the performance is deficient. So it is not NAFLA barred because it couldn't have been resolved. That's the word the Supreme Court used in Leak, or decided, which is the word the Supreme Court used in Torres, on the direct appeal alone.
And
it's
that
perfectly
would have been true, your argument would be, of the things that we so-called preserve, the only reason we're preserving them is they happen to have been brought, but had they never been brought, there would have been no NAFLA bar because they needn't.
That's correct, Your Honor. They are functionally the same. It's functionally the same to bring something that can't be resolved and not bring it at all. The issue is, could it have been resolved on direct appeal? The answer is no, and therefore, even though I agree the post-conviction court got the facts a little goofed up in its preservation ruling, the post-conviction court correctly ruled on the merits of the ineffective assistance issue. It just got the result of that wrong. And that gives me back to a little bit to the standard of review that I wanted to make sure to highlight. The Minnesota Supreme Court, again, has been clear. Not only are ineffective assistance claims generally reviewed de novo because they're mixed questions of fact and law, but the specific question of whether trial counsel's decisions are reasonable trial strategy or not is a question of law reviewed de novo. Nix holds that in the first footnote of the opinion, page 504, footnote 1. That had been a little up in the air, actually, before Nix, and Nix in 2013 resolved that question in favor of a de novo review. So the fact that the post-conviction court thought this was a trial strategy is not irrelevant, but this court owes no deference to that conclusion. In addition to the highlighting concern being completely unreasonable, well, let me get back to that for one thing. It is not ineffective assistance, of course, to fail to object to admissible evidence. Neither the state nor the trial court nor the post-conviction court has ever said that this evidence is admissible. The post-conviction judge here was the trial court judge, and it would have been really easy for her to deny this claim on post-conviction by saying, I would have overruled your objection. No problem. So there's no problem here. But she didn't say that. And the state didn't even ask her to say that, and she didn't. And I think that's very telling, that she doesn't say, this is no problem, it would have come in either way. She says, I can't do anything because this is strategic. That's, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but the word she uses, cannot. I cannot find counsel's performance deficient because counsel testified that his decision to object was tactical. That's wrong. And again, Nix says that that's wrong. Nix at page 507 says that whether something is strategic or tactical is a, quote, factor to consider, but is, quote, not an impregnable barrier to ineffective assistance claims. That rule would be formalistic and is not one that we follow here in Minnesota and is not the Strickland rule. I see I'm out of time, so I'll simply ask the court to reverse Mr. Edwards' conviction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Peter Marker representing the state. I'm going to get to the merits, but I really want to start with the bar. I think this is a very important question for this court to get its analysis correct on. So Mr. Butler talked about Torres and Leek, and I want to talk about those cases too. Torres was from 2004, and we know from Torres that if a claim cannot be decided on the trial court record, if a claim can be decided on the trial court record, it must be brought on direct appeal.
And how can we decide this on the trial court record?
Well, Your Honor, and then by way of answering your question, then 3 weeks, or, I'm sorry, 3 years later in Leek, we have the very claim that's raised here, the failure to object to inadmissible hearsay by trial counsel. Again, the failure to object to inadmissible hearsay by trial counsel. The Supreme Court does not review the claim. Specifically, Leek at page 542, the Supreme Court finds the claim barred because it was known or should have been known on direct appeal. This case is indistinguishable from Leek. Leek controls.
Well, Leek says, you know, it talks about the reason why defense counsel might want it in and says, quote, thus there were sound strategic reasons for Leek's counsel not to object to the admission of hearsay. Because we conclude that the failure to object involved trial strategy, blah, blah. I mean, that sounds, I have two points, I guess, in response. Is I don't know that Leek says an absolutely unreasonable strategy that's like unsound and, you know, like irrationally predicated is unreviewable. I mean, Leek seems to actually explain why there was a sound strategy. Secondly, my question about the NAFLA bar, though, is the things that were brought in the direct appeal and then sent to post-conviction or preserved for post-conviction review don't seem that different from this. Like the argument that there was vouching testimony or the admission of illegally seized evidence. I mean, those things are... How is that different from the hearsay
sure.
evidence? So it seems kind of funny to single this one out and say, well, this one, no, well, but the other one's yes.
Let me get to your first point first, if I may, Your Honor. Leek's discussion of trial strategy, and I really urge this court to take a close look at that discussion, is as to the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim, not trial counsel. When it comes to the trial counsel claim, Leek is very clear that claim is barred. Because it should have been brought on direct appeal. The discussion of strategy in Leek pertains only to the failure to raise an appellate counsel claim, which, of course, can be made post-direct appeal.
But the appellate counsel, I mean, I haven't reread it. I'm just looking at the parts. I mean, appellate counsel, ineffective claims have to be based on ineffective trial counsel, and then the part I read was actually talking about the soundness of the strategy at trial counsel.
But the only reason the court is even looking at that strategy issue is because there was, in Leek, an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim. We don't have that here. We only have an ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim, which, applying Leek for lack of a hearsay objection, must be brought on direct appeal.
And how would direct appeal provide us with the rationale? Or you're saying the rationale, the strategic rationale is irrelevant?
Well,
because we wouldn't really have that unless you could infer it from something.
On direct appeal. Appellant could have stayed the proceeding, happens all the time, before this court and sought post-conviction proceedings to develop the record. Now, we would have argued at that point then whether it's reviewable because it's strategy. We would have had that argument, and that's the appropriate time to have that argument. But so there is a process by which that decision, that strategy decision could have been reviewed. Post-direct appeal, though, after leak, and...
So you think leak requires it to be raised on direct appeal, even if there's no question whatsoever that direct appeal could not resolve it and that it needs to go to post-conviction?
I don't know how to read leak any differently than that, because there is no appellate counsel claim here. There is only a trial counsel claim here. Let me...
Well, the only weakness, it seems to me, in your argument is that in leak, the Supreme Court said decisions about objections at trial are matters of trial strategy, period. And the argument being made here is not so fast. You know, not every single failure to object is necessarily trial strategy.
And I agree with that, Your Honor. I don't dispute that. There must be some strategic decisions that are reviewable. It just has to be brought on direct appeal. I mean, after leak is...
If it can't be proved up, the unreasonableness of it can't be proved up on direct appeal, you're saying you still have to bring it there and then ask to go to post-conviction.
Correct.
But that's not the procedural posture of leak. So I'm wondering...
It was a post-appeal, post-conviction proceeding. And so when appellant argues against my bar argument, he cites cases that are in opposite. Nix, for example, was a direct appeal post-conviction proceeding.
Right. Okay. I mean, leak is post-conviction because it's the appellate counsel. But we don't have a one-to-one case that says in this where it's a trial attack on trial counsels.
But, Your Honor, this was an attack on trial counsel in leak. And yes. That claim should have, the Supreme Court says it, because Leake should have known of his ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim on direct appeal, it is barred under NAFLA. That is at page 542. That was a hearsay claim for failure to object. By the way, the judge in Leake said, geez, it seems like there's a lot of inadmissible hearsay coming in here. But the Minnesota Supreme Court said, no, we don't look at that. You should have raised that on direct appeal. Now, I understand counsel's argument that, well, how can you ever look at strategy if that's the rule? But the way you look at strategy is you bring it on direct appeal. That's what should have happened here. On direct appeal, Your Honors, we'd like to stay the appeal to pursue post-conviction relief. And we can develop the record there. We can fight there about strategy, which we do all the time, while a direct appeal is pending. But once you've had your direct appeal, applying leak, you may not raise a failure to object to hearsay evidence post-direct appeal in a post-conviction proceeding. If this court rules differently than that, it is confusing in light of leak. Because Leake could not be more clear on that.
But
and there
if,
is...
If just, I'm trying to process this, but if that's the rule, then it isn't the claim for Mr. Butler to challenge appellate counsel in the earlier proceeding.
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Butler was appellate counsel, and there's no better appellate counsel.
I understand that, but I mean,
but
wouldn't he be challenging?
Well, Your Honor, Justice Strass in Williams versus State, I have a cite for you, addressed that issue. And said, appellant can raise an ineffective assistance of appellate counsel claim pro se if he wishes. That didn't happen here. So he has the opportunity to do it pro se. We don't have that here. So again, please look closely at Leake in light of Torres. There is no way to rule inconsistently with Leake. Now, he can ask the Supreme Court to revisit Leak. That's fine. And say, look, the strategy here was so outrageous that it should be able to be raised post-direct appeal. Change your wording from Leak. But Lee couldn't be more clear. This claim is barred, procedurally barred by NAFLA. Now, I do want to get to the merits of it, and because I understand that even if you find it barred, this court often sort of looks at the merits anyway. I ask it that you don't. I ask that you rule consistent with Lee and just find it barred. But if you do review it, there is a, as this court knows, a very strong presumption of reasonableness that applies to defense counsel's actions. And the presumption here is backed by the record, where there is an extensive two-day post-conviction hearing record made in this proceeding. And Mr. Zitko testified, look, this was my strategy. I wasn't going to highlight something to make them, referring to the jury, think, well, why are they objecting to something that she just said she lied about? And I wasn't going to draw what would be unnecessary attention to something she said she lied about. I understand the argument that that's unreasonable. That might not be the strategy that every defense lawyer chooses, but is it constitutionally ineffective? The answer has to be no. Look, there were two defense lawyers in that, this is a joint trial, two experienced defense lawyers in that courtroom. Neither one of them objected to the evidence that they're claiming they should have objected to in order for it to be effective counsel. And a district court judge who spent the entirety of her prejudicial career as a defense lawyer. And so everyone in there, this evidence just came in. It's consistent with his strategy to not, and as he is cross-examining witnesses, some of the state's witnesses, including the victim's mother and her aunt, who I think was actually her cousin, he got them both to testify that the victim, T.S., lies all the time. It was consistent with his strategy. And that, I would invite your attention to the transcript at page 720, 694, and 697 for that testimony. And importantly, the MCRC video, which was lawfully admitted, as this court determined on direct appeal, was extraordinarily damaging. And it came in before T.S.'s testimony. And Mr. Zitko testified, look, once that came in, and he objected to that, and we argued about the admissibility of that on direct appeal. Judge Barcher overruled that objection. Once that came in, and once the victim got up and said, look, none of this happened, I lied about it, then he said, look, fine, I'm going to let this stuff come in. I don't want to highlight it. There is no controlling case that says that's constitutionally ineffective assistance. The foreign decisions that counsel relies on, those state court cases take a much more proactive approach to evaluating attorney strategy than Minnesota courts take.
Did the court also admit the recording of the victim's 911 call?
I didn't look at that for this, Your Honor. I don't remember. I guess I assume so, but I don't remember. So there was evidence, and let's remember, under the sex trafficking statute, the definition of sex trafficking is quite broad as far as implicating a defendant. I mean, it covers everything from receiving, recruiting, enticing, harboring, providing, or obtaining by any means an individual to aid in the prostitution of the individual, or receiving profit or anything of value, having reason to know that it was derived from prostitution.
And I apologize. It wasn't a 911 call. I was confused with another case. It was an email to Backpage.
Oh.
Sorry.
That did come in, if I'm remembering correctly. I guess in the final seconds I have here, again, I really urge this court to take a very close look at Leek.
So I'm wondering about Leek, and I am, and I completely understand. I want to hear and rebuttal, like, why, what's wrong with your analysis? But I'll ask you this question. Although it's circular, is the idea in, I mean, I find it, I'm going to confess, somewhat confusing. If you must bring issues that could be resolved in direct appeal, but you don't need to, well, I don't know, I guess you're saying even if it can't, they must be brought according to Leek. I don't know, is Leek decided the way it is? It's very brief, that part about trial counsel. And then it goes on to basically resolve the issue on direct appeal, but in the context of deciding the appellate.
Right, it doesn't resolve the issue, Your Honor.
Well, I mean it says that there were sound strategic reasons, and it seems to say that that was not ineffective by the trial counsel. I mean, it seems to imply that, at least that the failure to object.
As to the appellate counsel claim. And so...
Well, it's talking... I guess...
In order to evaluate...
Is the idea of Leek that you have to bring things that can be resolved there, but it doesn't necessarily speak to whether you have to bring things that can't be resolved?
Well, I'm out of time, but can I just... 10 seconds? I think you can read Leek narrowly, if you wish, and say, look, it only applies to unobjected to hearsay, perhaps, but that's what we have here. It is controlling. This court should not rule contrary to Leek. If the Supreme Court wants to revisit Leek, it can. I thank you for your time. I ask that you find that the matter is barred and otherwise without merit. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
Thank you. I think I have the answer, Judge Smith.
Oh, good.
I'm not sure.
Leek looks like it says, nope, not full stop.
Yep.
No analysis, full stop.
Here's where I think counsel for the state is trying to expand the NAFLA rule. The NAFLA rule, and as articulated in Leek, says that a claim has to be able to be resolved on the trial court record alone. Counsel agrees that this claim could not be resolved on the trial court record alone.
Leek?
I'm sorry, Leek at page 535. Going into 536, a claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel that cannot be resolved on the trial court record alone need not be brought in a direct appeal. Counsel agrees that that wasn't true here. So what counsel says is, well, what you should have done then is stay your direct appeal and done your post-conviction petition as while the direct appeal was stayed. And that's certainly an option, but it is not required. And there is no source of authority. And that's how the state here is trying to expand the NAFLA rule to say it's not just the trial court record alone. It would be the trial court record as expanded in a post-conviction petition brought during a state direct appeal.
But isn't that exactly why counsel asked this court to stay the proceedings so that
sure.
post-conviction relief can be sought to avoid NAFLA?
Yeah. And sometimes that's how these cases are litigated, and sometimes they're not. But it is the rules of procedure make that a permissive choice for the defendant. There's no requirement in the case law or in the post-conviction statute that a defendant who wants to go beyond the trial court record, I mean, in Anderson, spelled with an E, a Minnesota Supreme Court case, the Supreme Court refers to the trial court transcript. That if the claim can be resolved on the basis of the trial court transcript. There's no requirement that if you have to go beyond the trial court transcript, you have to stay your direct appeal and do your post-conviction petition then, as opposed to complete your direct appeal and then do your post-conviction petition. For example, if that wouldn't make any sense, because if this court had reversed Mr. Edwards' conviction in the direct appeal, we would never have to get to post-conviction relief. We wouldn't need a subsequent post-conviction petition. Because the court affirmed Mr. Edwards' conviction on direct appeal, now is the opportunity to go beyond the trial court transcript or the trial court record alone, as the language is used in Leek, and say... And make claims that need an expanded record. And that's exactly what happened in one of the other cases.
But Leek is still a little bit confusing to me, I'm going to say, because you're citing the language at the beginning that sort of general rules.
Yep.
And then when we get to the actual analysis of the failure to object on page, whatever page that is,
mm-hmm.
you know, the court doesn't analyze whether it was resolvable or not without, it just says, because he should have known on direct appeal is barred by NAFLA. It doesn't, it, you know what I mean? I don't understand the connection between
And I agree, Your Honor, and there are many opinions using many different words to describe when a claim has to be brought on direct appeal, things like known or resolvable. But the standard, what I would ask this court to follow is actually the standard of review at the beginning of that paragraph in Leak, which is repeated, comes from Torres and is repeated in Anderson and is repeated in other cases, which is where the claim is resolvable, where the reviewing court can resolve it. It has to be brought on direct appeal. Just think about what would happen if on direct appeal we had brought this claim. This ineffective assistance, and we didn't stay it to do a post-conviction because we don't have to. But we had brought it on direct appeal. This court would have said what it said when Mr. Edwards did that in his pro se claims. We can't resolve this because we don't know what counsel's reasons for not objecting are. So go off and do your post-conviction. So here we are. We went off and did the post-conviction. We know now why counsel didn't object. We know in this the post-conviction court can evaluate, and this court can evaluate the legitimacy of those reasons and can decide whether counsel's performance was deficient or not. This court could not have done that on direct appeal, and that's why the claim is not barred. I did want to note one thing about the note that you mentioned, Your Honor, the victim's email.
Yes.
To Backpage. That did not refer to Mr. Edwards. The question of whether this victim was trafficked by someone is a very different question than whether the victim was trafficked by Mr. Edwards. It's also a different question than whether the victim was trafficked by Ms. Yusuf, the co-defendant. There's a lot of evidence that she was trafficked by Ms. Yusuf. There is, other than this hearsay evidence that counsel waved on through into the trial as substantive evidence of guilt, there's not a lot of evidence that she was trafficked by Mr. Edwards. Sure, the jury could have weighed and made this decision or a different decision, but the impact of that hearsay evidence cannot be overstated.
All right, thank you for that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The matter has been well argued, and it is taken under advisement. That concludes our oral calendar. We are in recess to our non-oral calendar. Thank you.
All right.